Welcome to Dig Life Deep with John Aidan Byrne.
Edward Habsburg is the Archduke of Austria, Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See, and the Sovereign Order of Malta. His family reigned in Austria, Hungary, Germany, Spain, and quite a few other places. He is a diplomat and social media personality. Edward and his wife, Baroness Maria Theresia von Gudenus, have 6 children. Edward is the author of several books, including the children's tome, Doobie, the Double-Headed Eagle, volumes on Thomas Aquinas, James Bond and Harry Potter, novels and screenplays. And Archduke Edward Habsburg is my guest coming up. Essentially, your empire, if that's the right word, disappeared in 1918. Your family abdicated. Yes. But there's an interesting side to that, because unlike in some countries where royalty has renounced its political power, your abdication as a family was not so much binding as definitive. The door is still open to further generations of the Habsburgs ascending the throne again, as it were. Do you ever see that happening?
Never say never again. I would say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
We'll have my full interview with Archduke Edward Habsburg of Austria in a moment. We covered a lot of history and territory, and he opens up on his family, his family's legacy, his deep faith, Hungary's sometimes complicated and controversial relationship as a socially conservative member of the European Union, as well as Hungary's strong support for families in Hungary. Archduke Edward Habsburg is author of the new book from Sophia Institute Press. It's called The Habsburg Way, 7 Rules for Turbulent Times, which has a foreword from the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban. Now, inflation, interest rates, the banking crisis, fears of a recession or perhaps a soft landing or a hard landing, what is happening in China. If you want to get an up-to-date insight on all of these hot-button financial topics and more, catch the top-rated Odeon Capital Conversations podcast each week on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Odeon Capital Conversations features the well-known bank analyst Dick Beauvais of Odeon Capital Group and Odeon co-founder and managing partner Matt Van Alstyn. It's a superb combination on the financial topics of our time. I'm happy to host the Odeon Capital Conversations podcast each week and get great perspective from Dick Beauvais and Matt Van Alstyn of Odeon Capital Group. We'll have my interview coming up in a wee moment with Edward Habsburg, the Archduke of Austria and the Ambassador of Hungary to the Holy See. Before we get to that, it's back to finance and markets for our regular Future Shock 2.0 segment with workforce trends expert Ira Wolf. Ira Wolf, welcome back for Future Shock 2.0. The unemployment rate in the US is now at 3.5%, just a tad up from where it was in January. But we see rising unemployment claims, and we have forecasts from a lot of economists that it's going to rise later in the year, and we may shift from gangbuster job growth to actual job losses on a monthly basis. The Fed's interest rate rising campaign is kicking in. Credit conditions are tightening. We had the recent bank crisis. A lot of consumers are strapped for cash and have spent a lot of that COVID money that was issued during the pandemic. How do you see it shaping up?
Yeah, thanks, John. We've talked about this a lot. But, you know, we were talking about prolonged unemployment, that we've had 12 recessions since 1945, and no recession up to this point has unemployment been below 6%. So the common kind of the traditional approach to this was the Fed raises interest rates, the economy slows down, especially with inflation, things became more costly, businesses cut back and laid off people. And some of that we've seen, but it's not global. It's not universal. Certainly technology has been hard hit, and then all the impacted businesses around them. But there's still businesses that are really struggling to find people, despite what happens with the economy, and people may not be able to afford it. But we still need healthcare workers. We still have an aging population. We're still manufacturing goods. We still have transportation. So all those industries, maybe the growth slows, but it can't stop because we need them on an everyday basis. But on the unemployment rate, you know, I've been saying this for a while based on everything that I've read, is that, you know, again, we're still debating whether we have a recession or not, whether it'll be a soft landing, whether we ever have a recession. But most people are predicting that it's going to be relatively short. But we were predicting that the unemployment rate would go up to maybe 4.5%. You know, we're far from that. We're a full percentage point off that, you know, right now. So will it go up to 4 to 5%? Yeah, probably, but it's still far. But I remember a time when 5% unemployment was full employment. So we're sort of going back to that stage, but it's not the 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% that we've had in some prior, you know, recessions, or even going back to, you know, 2008, 2009, when it was significantly, you know, higher. So it's going to, but here's the outlier. And I've raised this question a million times. Is that since 1945, we've had baby boomers coming into the work. And then, so for 20 years, we had baby boomers, and then we had Gen X. But there were so many baby boomers coming in that the Gen X blip, which is only half the size of baby boomers, didn't really impact it. But we still had new blood coming into the workforce. And then we had the millennials, which is even a larger population. So since 1950 to 2010, we had baby boomers, Gen X, and millennials, almost about 2 million people a year, new workers a year, were coming into the workforce. If you look at a chart now, you lop off the baby boomers and you look at Gen Z, and then the next generation is Gen Alpha. So if you look over the next 15 to 20 years, there's on average 500,000 new workers a year coming in versus 2 million new workers coming in. So yes, we can have a lot of people laid off and a lot of people out of jobs. Some of those jobs are going to be automated, but a lot of those people are going to retire, are going to be out of the workforce. But we don't have new blood coming in, and we're certainly not going to get a immigration policy passed, which every economist also agrees that if we have a robust economy, if we are creating jobs, if we have these jobs open, that we need immigration to help solve it, because we don't have enough warm bodies. So as we lose the baby boomers, and we don't have these, the younger population just aren't as robust. I mean, they're a quarter of the size. Then we could afford to have unfilled jobs if some of those jobs are automated. So there could be less people employed, and we still have a growing economy with a higher GDP. The problem is now we have a larger dependent society. So we have more people that are unemployed or unemployable because of skill gaps. So it's really complicated. So if we strictly look at the unemployment rate, I think it's going to be 4 to 5%, but that's just scratching the surface of what some of the challenges are. And again, if we're looking at us having a high GDP or a growing GDP, and even relatively moderate unemployment. We're in this never normal world, but we're going to have a lot more people that are out of work. But I think the economy can still grow. But then we just start dividing our society into the haves and the have-nots.
Ira Wolf, another jaw-dropping and mind-blowing segment. We'll have you back next week. Thank you. More from Ira Wolf on our next episode. Ira is a workforce trends expert, a top 5 global thought leader in his field, author, TEDx talker, and host of the top-rated Geeks, Geezers, and Googleization podcast. I'm your host, John Aidan Byrne.
We keep digging for the secrets and stories of uncommon and everyday things and interesting people.
My guest is Archduke Eduard Habsburg of Austria. He's Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See and the Sovereign Order of Malta. The Archduke is author of a new book from Sophia Institute Press. It's called The Habsburg Way, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times. The interview with the Archduke in Rome was taped recently from our studios in the New York area. Some audio in a few spots was interrupted by static, just a tad, not much, because of the connections, I believe, out of Rome. But overall, it is just a fine and splendid interview, and you will enjoy what Eduard Habsburg is going to reveal. And you'll also be able to catch this full interview with the Archduke Eduard Habsburg of Austria on our YouTube channel, Dig Life Deep. I'm your host, John Aidan Byrne. Eduard, welcome to my show. It's not every day of the week I get to interview somebody of your stature. You are the Archduke of Austria, the ambassador of Hungary to the Holy See. You're the Sovereign Order of Malta, and you're here to tell me about your life, your family, your legacy, and it's really fascinating and interesting. And you also have a new book out, The Habsburg Way. I just had to get this out of the way in case I get into some trouble with my many friends and listeners and family in Ireland. I grew up there and we weren't very much into the monarchy, of course, because Irish history, as you know, was littered with terrible bloodshed relating to various conquests. And of course, we got the monarchy out of a good section of Ireland, and they were a Protestant monarchy. But you come from this from a different perspective, because yours was a Catholic monarchy. And I did some reading up on you, and I read through the Habsburg Way, and I think you have a different story, and it's certainly worth listening to. First of all, welcome again to the show. You're based in Rome. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your family.
I'm 56 years old, married. I have six children. So the way it used to be in Ireland a few decades ago, I wasn't always a diplomat. I'm only an ambassador since 7 years. Before that, I was a spokesman for a Catholic bishop. Before that, I wrote screenplays and novels and books. So I worked on Thomas Aquinas and Thomistic philosophy. So it is quite it's quite a different path diplomacy that I went. I am here, as you said, I'm the ambassador of Hungary to the Holy See, which of course is the Vatican, at the same time to the Sovereign Order of Malta. And I'm enjoying every second since I'm here in Rome. I like to tell journalists it's a bit like if you like chocolate and have been locked into a chocolate factory for the night.
But you grew up in Germany, correct? Your dad was a refugee from Hungary.
Yes, my father's family fled during Second World War from Hungary, then lost their citizenship. My father was without citizenship when he was in Germany, where he met my mother. We were born half German, half no citizenship. Then my father got his Hungarian citizenship back, and so I became Hungarian again. But I spent most of my life outside of Hungary, and my first language was German. I had to relearn Hungarian to become ambassador, and it was a nightmare because it's a very beautiful but extremely difficult language if you don't grow up speaking it. That's my very special position here.
I'm just kind of fascinated by the idea of Catholic monarchy. And again, I give you my Irish background. I don't know what the reaction is going to be in Ireland, but I hope they will hear you out because you've seemed to have lived a really good life, and a lot of your family have done extraordinary things throughout history. And you weren't aggressors as such. You have a lot of cousins and spread all over Europe and the world. Your empire spread far and wide. In fact, it even laid claim to some lands in America at one point. This is going back centuries.
Yes. Well, John, there are some prejudices against empires and monarchies in general, especially in the English-speaking world in the United States. The United States are built on the myth of fighting tyrants and rulers, and that's a good thing for the United States. The Habsburg Empire, and most of all the Holy Roman Empire, that the Habsburgs ruled over for a long time was a very different beast from what we imagine an empire to be. I blame Star Wars for the bad rap that empires get. I blame Star Wars because Star Wars gave us this idea of an absolute ruler terrorizing an entire galaxy with stormtroopers and then a band of rebels fighting him, which is a wonderful myth. In reality, the Holy Roman Empire that the Habsburgs had to rule over was far more complicated than that. From the first Habsburg ruler in 1273, being emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was mostly an incredibly complicated juggling act between different countries, different kingdoms, different languages, different laws, and had no real power. You had privilege as an emperor, but you had no money, no power, and you were in a constant juggling game, a 3D game of chess, I would say. Very complicated. And that led to the Habsburgs from the beginning having to balance between different countries. Habsburgs never belonged to one nation, never. And that led to them working mostly through marriage and family politics and not through conquest. The Habsburgs were never conquerors. Now, if you're an emperor over one nation, you may feel tempted to enlarge your power by conquering neighboring nations. The Habsburgs, from the beginning, had to juggle so many different nationalities. Temptation for conquest was never there, and therefore their path was through marriage and through alliances by marrying off their many children to neighboring countries. And this was mostly within Catholic boundaries. I mean, up to a certain point in history, of course, all the rulers in Europe were Catholic because there was only Catholic. And after that, of course, we had the Reformation. But after that, also the Habsburgs, 99.5% only married Catholic families and into Catholic families and built the networks among Catholic families. So if you sit down like I did for my book and you ask yourself what are the central principles of the Habsburg, I would say the first two things that will spring to mind is Catholic and marriage. Habsburgs got married a lot, had lots of children. I have six, as I told you. And so ours is a very different beast from, for instance, from the English monarchy, which also somehow always touched neighboring countries, but only on an island and the neighboring island. And with the Habsburgs, it was a very different beast. But can I just go on and tell you, John, that in a way, within the Habsburg Empire, there was a similar situation to how the Irish felt about the English monarchy. And that is the way the Hungarians felt about the Vienna Habsburg monarchy. Hungary was first conquered by the Ottomans, by the Muslims, after 1526 and occupied for about 170 years by Ottoman forces. And after that, it went to the Habsburgs, but they always, for many centuries, felt this as a sort of suppression and tyranny they had to fight against. Hungarians are incredibly proud people, proud of their language, proud of their customs, of their local laws, of their privileges, and they felt the Habsburgs as an oppression. That came to an absolute critical point in 1848, when then young Emperor Franz Joseph brutally let the generals of the Hungarian uprising be executed. So for Hungarians, Habsburgs is still a topic that is slightly touchy. And the interesting thing is that, of course, in 1867, finally Habsburg and Hungary got to agree on a sort of agreement, which was the Ausgleich. And then after that, things calmed down and both sides were really happy to be in this monarchy together. But I suppose it's more complicated in England and in Ireland, right?
The memory, I can't even use the phrase lingers on. It was such a brutal part of our background, the Oliver Cromwell and the penal laws, the suppression of religion, English language and so on. So that would explain a lot of the antipathy to monarchy in Ireland. But speaking of Catholic monarchy and your own family legacy, at the time of the Reformation, according to your book, The Habsburg Way, members of your family did shift sides. There was shifts in allegiance. They were Catholic, and then they moved over to supporting the Protestant Reformation. But ultimately, it remained intact as a Catholic monarchy, correct?
Yes. Well, what we had was when Reformation sort of impacted the whole of Europe, the Catholic Church was very weak thought. The leadership of the Catholic Church at Luther's time wasn't very strong. And while the first Habsburg emperor that was confronted with Reformation, Emperor Charles V, was very, very clear on his judgment on Luther at the Diet of Worms, where he said that he thought he was an heretic. But his brother, his brother's son, and his brother's grandson were very much softer on Protestantism, or I would even say embrace some ideas of Protestantism. And that, of course, is not a good thing if you're a Catholic ruler. You can understand the emperors in a way, because half of their empire suddenly had to turn to Protestantism. And the Protestant princes made your life as an emperor very difficult if you didn't try to make some sort of compromise. But in the end, after about 70 years of being very wobbly emperors, mostly Maximilian II, and Rudolf, who resided in Prague and was a very complex character, and the Habsburgs returned to their Catholic roots strongly, and from then on became champions of Counter-Reformation and of Catholicism right to the very end in 1918. And we are still Catholic. We're still strongly Catholic. I would say, I think most members of our about 400 Habsburgs that we have right now spread all over the world are Catholic. So that's in brief the story of the Habsburg.
You have 400 members. I'll follow up on that in a moment. In your family, you have a brother, a priest. There was a saint came out of one of your family members. Was he beatified or is that in that process? And then there was another member going back centuries who founded a monastery.
Huh. Oh, don't get me started, John. Don't get me started. Dear. Oh, that's such a wonderful question. Okay, now beginning from now and going backwards, yes, we have three priests in the family right now, three Catholic priests, but for the last 200 years, we had no priests in the family. And that for a very Catholic family with tons of young men being born, this is not a good thing. Very proud to say that my brother is the first Habsburg priest after 200 years, more or less. But we are, as I say, we have three now. If I go back, yes, indeed, we have a blessed in our family who one day will be saint, and it is Blessed Emperor Karl, or Charles, the last emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He died in 1922, and he only ruled for 1.5 to 2 years. During the First World War, he tried to make peace as much as possible. And he was a wonderful man, happily married, 8 children, wonderful wife, for whom the process for beatification has also begun now. So those were the two in the 20th century. But we can go back to the 16th century. One daughter of Ferdinand I, the beautiful Magdalena, who has been painted by Arcimboldo when she was young. In fact, if you go on Twitter and you look at my current Twitter Habsburg Championship, where you can vote for your favorite Habsburgs, there is a beautiful painting of Magdalena. Magdalena wanted to become a nun and found a monastery. And her father, Emperor Ferdinand I, said, "No way, no way. I might send your youngest sister, she's weak, but you'll get married, and your sisters too." And then she persisted. St. Peter Canisius, Jesuit, famous Jesuit, encouraged her. He was her confessor. And in the end, the father relented that, okay, you can found a monastery. And she founded a monastery in Hall in Tyrol. And that was very successful. Lots of women joined that. And she also fought strongly for counter-reformation, for Catholic teaching, for Catholic books to spread them among the people of Tyrol. And then she died, and the monastery remained until the fateful year of 1780-something, when her very, very, very distant grand-nephew, Joseph II, had the grand idea to shut down half of all the monasteries in Austria, which were about 1,000 that he shut down, and every single contemplative monastery in Austria. And that also shut down the monastery founded by his own great-great-great-great-grand-aunt, Magdalena. But the story has a happy end, because the same blessed Karl that I talked about in the 20th century reopened that monastery with a new Catholic order. So sometimes these stories end happily. But it was a complicated history with ups and downs among the rulers. That's one of the topics of my book.
I would recommend people go and read The Habsburg Way, because the subtitle is, and we'll get to it in a moment, Seven Rules for Turbulent Times. And my goodness, are times turbulent? We'll talk about that in a moment. Is it fair to say that the Habsburgs were popular among their people, that they coexisted peacefully, and that they protected all that was good and defended the poor and encouraged industry and commerce? How did they fit into society in their heyday?
You can't ask a Habsburg whether the Habsburgs were good. What am I going to say? But I strongly believe, and I hope you believe it too when you read my book, that the Habsburgs really did everything they could to make their subjects' life better, to bring their countries into the next centuries, to fight for the rights of their people, for their languages, for subsidiarity, a topic that is very important nowadays, I believe. And one of the major reasons was because they were Catholic. And if you're Catholic, you profoundly believe that if you're an emperor and you're Catholic, you will have to give account of what you did one day in front of God. And he will judge you on whether you try to be a good emperor. And in my book, this keeps you from being corrupt, very overtly violent, egotistical, and gleefully oppressing your subjects. So I think, yes, the Habsburgs were good people. There is very little stories of, yes, I mentioned one or two things. The Hungarians suffered, but that story ended well too at the end. And you said correctly, the title of my book is Seven Rules for Turbulent Times, because I don't want to stop at speaking about what the Habsburgs thought were important principles or rules of life, but I want to propose them for our time. I think we live in turbulent times, and you know, thinking about what are the several central things that our family always stood for, and then looking around me in today's world, I realized, wow, these are seven things that we have lost from sight a bit, that aren't very popular in today's politics, that our politicians, our society, too well to look at again. And Michael Knowles, in his comments on my book, wrote that I've redeemed the self-help book, which is very funny.
Yeah, we'll get to the book in a moment. But essentially, your empire, if that's the right word, disappeared in 1918. Your family abdicated. Yes. But there's an interesting side to that, because unlike in some countries where royalty has renounced its political power, your abdication as a family was not so much binding as definitive. The door is still open to further generations of the Habsburgs ascending the throne again, as it were. Do you ever see that happening?
Never say never again. I would say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Many things have happened in history. Right now, I don't see Austria spontaneously rising to form a monarchy. As I say, monarchy has been the main and the favorite and the most Catholic of all forms of state for several thousand years. It is something that has worked quite well for a while. It is out of fashion right now. But I mean, some of the best countries in Europe are monarchies. And in my experience, the people who have been raised to be monarchs in different European countries, I write about this in my book, are people who have learned to serve their country. Now, most politicians nowadays don't have a chance to grow up from their childhood, getting to know every fault line and every power and every important group in your country under the aspect of serving them, of putting yourself last so that the country can thrive. This is a thought that is absolutely alien to our world nowadays. If you're a politician today, you know that you will be able to work for a few years in politics, and then you find a comfortable place where you can live off your relations. No, not all politicians. There are very good politicians out there. But the temptation is very great to at some point say, okay, that's it. I'm going into business now and I'll earn a lot of money and have a wonderful, you will never be bothered again with all the responsibilities of your country because you're out. A monarch doesn't have that luxury. A monarch will have to live with his or her decisions all their life and their children too. So that puts all of this into a very different perspective. And
so they have a vested interest in the outcomes of all their decisions and actions, you're saying here.
Yes. I mean, I'm depicting, of course, the ideal monarch. There are people who are intellectually limited. There are people who are egotistical. But the few monarchs that are ruling now, I got to meet quite a few of them when they were princes in training. And I had the chance to talk with them. And I realized that some of them simply live in countries with different languages. And they will never use one language more than the other in order to balance their country. They will never show perhaps their Catholic faith as strongly as they would like to because there is also Protestant in their country. No, all these things point to very cautious, very much pointing to service. And yes, I have made good experiences with the current monarch. But I can tell you honestly, John, I think that if a Habsburg monarchy would ever come back, I don't think it would make much sense if it were simply a constitutional monarchy the way that most of them are today, where the monarch is a better president with some golden crown on his head. If we want a monarchy, we would want to have back a real monarchy. And as I don't see this spontaneously happening right now, we're waiting. You know, Habsburg can play the waiting game. We're around, and if people call us, we can come back.
So there's 400 or so of the family, extended family, cousins and so on, spread around the globe, probably in Europe, I would imagine most. Do you still have castles? Do you have gatherings and where you dress up in regalia and you have all ceremony and ritual? And
we are about 400. I said quite a few of them are in the States too, so don't feel too secure. We are everywhere. I have some in Africa. We have some cousins in Australia. So, yeah, we're really everywhere. Yes, we meet. We meet every few years. We have a big gathering. We had one in 2022. That was the centenary of the death of Blessed Emperor Karl. And we all went to Madeira, where he died, to the island of Madeira. But as going around in regalia, we don't do that much. Most of us are wearing normal clothing. And you see, I'm not even wearing a tie when talking to you. But yeah. There are occasions where we wear regalia. I am a member of the Order of the Golden Fleece. Some of our family are, not too many. I'm among the lucky few. And when we meet once a year, we wear this huge golden chain with a golden fleece on it. They have to take it from the safes and they put it back in after Mass. We wear it for one Mass and walk in very, very devoutly and pray with that. So yes, it exists, but it has become rather the exception than the rule. But one thing is fun. As I am ambassador to the Holy See, and the working outfit to the Holy See is a coat-tailed, what you call white tie, but with a black vest. I'm one of the few members of the Order of the Golden Fleece that can regularly wear the neck decorations of the Order of the Golden Fleece for my work in the Holy See, because this is encouraged when you go there. So you can see on Twitter pictures of me with a Golden Fleece dangling from my neck, because it's my working outfit at the Vatican.
Do you still own castles? Do you have a lot of land holdings? Do you have trust funds? Any of that?
From time to time, I stumble across conspiracy theory accounts on Twitter that claim that we are among the families ruling the world secretly, though, of course. We are not rich. We don't have money. We lost a war, so we don't have castles anymore. I would say among the 400 Habsburgs, there's perhaps one or two who live in a castle. But most of us live in a normal world out there, have normal jobs, have no property at all, and must make do as everybody else. What I feel is what we have in common is if you're a Habsburg, you sort of live your entire life under a spotlight. People will notice more what you do and what you don't do. And if you do something bad, it won't say Edward did something bad, but member of the Habsburg family did bad. So you are very much more visible if you're a Habsburg. And that has consequences for your life, because you realize that people look at you all your life from your childhood on, and you ask yourself, okay, what do I want to do with that? Whether I want it or not, am I a Habsburg? People will look at me and will look to me and have certain expectations. So you say, will I embrace it or will I reject it? Most of us do embrace this. And for most of us, it means responsibility. With great powers come great responsibilities, as Uncle Ben says to Spider-Man. And a bit of that. And you work for peace, you work for the understanding of people, you work for your Christian faith, you found families with lots of children, and then you see what history throws your way.
Hi, I'm Danica Patrick. Watching my nieces grow, play, and learn is amazing, but not every child gets to be carefree. 1 in 6 kids in the U.S. are hungry. This breaks my heart, and it's something that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and gives it to families in need. To help, visit feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My guest is Archduke Eduard Habsburg of Austria. He's Hungary's ambassador to the Holy See and the Sovereign Order of Malta. The Archduke is author of a new book from Sophia Institute Press. It's called The Habsburg Way, 7 Rules for Turbulent Times. I'm your host, John Aidan Byrne. You've made an independent career for yourself. You're now Hungarian ambassador to the Holy See, but you've had a career in as a writer of screenplays and been quite successful. And now you have your new book out. It's quite remarkable and interesting as well that you are the Hungarian ambassador to the Holy See, because Hungary is sometimes in the spotlight among the EU nations as a bit of a quote unquote an outlier, as it were. It doesn't always, it sometimes butts head with the EU bureaucracy, and it kind of is quite firm in its opinions. It's of all the EU countries, it's maybe one of the most conservative oriented. Would that be correct? How do you see Hungary and its relationship with the EU?
Well, first of all, everything you've said is correct, John. So you're a very astute observer of what's happening between Hungary and the EU and the neighboring countries. And Hungary is very stubbornly conservative and has very conservative values. That has to do with our history. As I've told you before, we've first been occupied by the Ottomans, then we've been occupied by the Habsburgs, so to speak. And after that, we've been occupied by the Russians and the communists. And after 1989, when freedom came back and Hungary was truly sovereign again, the Hungarians have developed this attitude of, we don't want people from outside of Hungary telling us what to do. And whenever someone from outside tries to mix into our decisions, to try to influence from outside what we decide inside Hungary, they put their hackles up, as they say. And that leads... on the one hand, I have to say, the Hungarian and the Poles are among the most enthusiastic supporters of the European Union. If you make polls among the population, yeah, you will find that they really love the idea of Europe and the European Union. But what I've said before is the Hungarians' clear ideas, they are very fiercely proud of their sovereignty, and they want to do their things their way. They react nervously when they feel that, for instance, Brussels is trying to influence what's going on inside Hungary and overreach. And you know, the central problem is here subsidiarity. The Habsburg Empire always tried to respect every single country in their empire by allowing all the languages to be spoken, allowing all the different legal systems to be implemented. The only times the Habsburg really screwed up was when they decided to become centralistic. And that was under Joseph II, and that was under the early years of Emperor Franz Joseph. In all the other centuries, the Habsburg did this differently. And the same lesson that we can learn from the EU, perhaps, try to respect the differences of the nations, also the small ones, also the ones in Central Europe, and everything will go more smoothly. And I'm very optimistic for the future of the European Union. I don't see any real trouble, but Hungary will fight for certain things and will butt heads for certain things. But it doesn't take away that we're enthusiastically inside the EU. And not just for money reasons, but really, the population believes in the EU.
You're optimistic about the future of the EU. You brought up the principle of subsidiarity. It's a big part of Catholic teaching. And you mentioned how the Habsburgs supported and encouraged that and screwed up maybe once, which you asked me earlier about the Windsors. Well, they weren't the Windsors back in the 19th century and earlier, but they took on the name the Windsors in the 20th century. But I think that was one of the big issues in terms of its relationship with Ireland, apart from all the bloody campaigns, was this idea of subsidiarity, because Ireland used to be a mostly Irish-speaking nation. And then so there was this whole idea of the getting us to speak the language of the conquerors. And then there were plantations, and then the language, or then the religious issue, obviously. We were Catholic and we were sticking with it, and they wanted us to become Protestant. It simply did not work. And ultimately, we saw the results of all of that. You recently gave an interview about Hungary, and you brought up something that speaks to your own life as a dad and a father of six. As Hungary's ambassador to the Vatican, you have been very impressed by what Hungary is doing for families. And I'm just quoting you, quoting this. The government of Hungary is running an ambitious program to encourage couples to have more children, which has resulted in a growing number of marriages and children, diminishing divorces and abortions.
Yes. This is a big thing in Hungary. And you know, we're a small country. We have less than 10 million inhabitants. And so if you want to make an ambitious project of that kind, you need to take the money from somewhere else. You need to have the entire government behind it. And since 2011, the Hungarian government has begun a policy of encouraging families to have more children. While still, that doesn't mean you need to be at home. You need to be a stay-at-home mom. On the contrary, if you want to go work, you can go work. But what Hungary is trying to do is to stop the demographic winter that we have in Europe right now, at least in Hungary. It's very strongly visible in Italy, for instance, very strongly. When I arrived here, and I drove my car, I like to drive car in Rome. It's fun. It's very different from the rest. It's very exciting to drive here, but it's fun. And I remember that I drove here, and after about 3 years, I stopped at a traffic light. And I saw a pregnant woman crossing the street. And said, oh, wow, this is a pregnant woman. And then I realized I had never noticed a pregnant woman in Rome in 3 years. So this is something, of course, in Hungary that is not the reality. You see that all the time in children. So while Hungary is still in a very dramatic place demographically, we have managed to turn around the trend. And the numbers of births are growing, the numbers of marriages are growing, as you said, the number of divorces is going down. But then, you know, this has been done by a combination of financial and economic help, you know, loans that you don't have to pay back if you have a certain amount of children, help for building houses, help for buying bigger cars, all sort of things. But the most important part for me is not the money. Although I am a father of six, so I know that every penny counts, as they say. But the most important thing is that you don't feel alone if you decide to have more than two children. For most people nowadays, especially here in Italy, they feel that it's a private hobby of theirs if they want to have more than two children. It's not responsible. I mean, you know what they're telling us, you're hurting the climate if you have children. But if you live in a country where the government, where the prime minister, where the president, where politicians, where people in sports show themselves with family, show themselves with their children, show themselves with their grandchildren, where when you land at Budapest airport, you have a poster in the airport saying, welcome to Hungary, family-friendly country. This is something that may give some people the courage to say, wow, having a bigger family is not just a private entertainment for me, but it's a contribution to a state that welcomes this. I would like to see this in many, many countries in the world, because I believe that a family with children and with numerous children is the foundation of a stable state.
Because it's a huge problem. You talked about the demographic winter. Only for high levels of immigration to America, and it's it receded during COVID, but there are still high levels of immigration into America relative to a lot of other countries. We would be experiencing the same kind of declines in populations as you're seeing in lots of parts of the West. In fact, the fertility rate in America today is under 2%. So we're making up with the shortfall with immigration. And that's widespread throughout Europe. You raised a really interesting point. I don't know if we will see the time where American leaders would say, gee, yeah, it's good to have more kids. It's good for social stability. It's good for economic prosperity. There's so many areas it touches upon. It certainly is a huge issue.
You know, I can speak from experience. I see my children now. The youngest is now 14. The eldest is 26. I see them, and I see children that are happy, that know that they will always have someone who has their back, their siblings, who grew up happily. If I and my wife die tomorrow in a plane crash, they will support each other, help each other. They're very close. But most of all, what I like to tell is how you learn democracy around the dinner table. If you sit around the dinner table in eight, and we sat in eight for a long time, you cannot afford to be egotistical. You learn that in our family it was tradition that you first serve the youngest. You learn that the weakest get first. You learn to take responsibility in what you say, for instance. The elders can't talk about frightening things because the youngest won't sleep at night. Also, the youngest will learn from their siblings. They will take their opinions and learn and apply them to their life. And you will also learn to, for instance, our youngest daughter always tries to say something, but the others speak so loudly. I have five daughters and one son, so it's very loud around our dinner table. And when the youngest speaks, for the third time, she can't get through. She will cry and run out of the room, not now anymore, but a few years ago. And the siblings will call her back, and they will learn they have to give voice to those who can't get through the noise. All of these things you learn around the dinner table in a family with many siblings. Also, you learn that you can afford everything and that the central issue in life is not consuming, because you cannot afford. If you have eight or nine children, I only had six, one visit to the cinema with popcorn equals a flight to a luxurious island, you know, and yeah. So many, many, many things speak for numerous families. And not last, this is a place where you really learn faith in a time where we sometimes feel that the church hierarchy is a bit weak. Your family is a place where you learn faith. And it's also a place where ideologies and sometimes even state ideologies can't butt in. If the family can be a fortress, can be a place where you can teach your children your values without ideologies coming in.
You can get a lot of life's lessons around the family dinner table. Of course, in America, at least in the 60s, there was a phrase that grew up out of that whole emerging TV culture then, was the TV dinner phenomena. Somebody grabbed something out of the freezer and sat in front of the TV, but there were no family dinner times. But there are. I mean, our family has dinner together. My kids are probably a little older than yours, but we did that, and we still do it. But it's not as common as you would imagine. Only people are rushed, especially in the bigger cities. The idea of family dinner time is unfortunately not as common as you would imagine.
Yes. Yeah. But it takes courage. I remember my wife told me when she got married to me, all of her friends said, you can't get married and have children. You have to work for many, many, many years and then perhaps have one child before it's too late. But you can't do that. It's ridiculous. You make yourself ridiculous if you decide to be a stay-at-home mom. She was a stay-at-home mom. Mm-hmm. We worked before, but she stopped when we began having children. And she said, this was what I was looking for all my life. But you have a bad conscience if you do that as a woman nowadays. Many people feel they can't afford for one part of the family to stay at home, because it's life has become very expensive. So yeah, I know about all of this. I don't have rose-tinted views on the difficult side of family. I know that the kind of family life that I present in my book and that I speak about, and that was the reality in Habsburg history, seems rose-tinted nowadays, but it isn't. It isn't. It always depends on two people trying to begin again and build this up. And I think it will heal society. I think society will be healed through family.
We're living in turbulent times, and you offer us 7 rules. I don't need to ask you to describe the turbulent times we're living in. There's social disorder. We have the terrible conflict in the Ukraine. We have family breakdowns. You referred to abortion there earlier. We have that in America and in Europe. Social isolation, economic stress. And we don't have enough time to ask the question why. Somebody said famously recently, I just thought it was a brilliant quote, that America doesn't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. In other words, we are actually a very productive nation, but we're spending way beyond our means. So when we talk about economic stress, we have to see it in a big wider context. Be that as it may, when economies go through these difficult times, ordinary people, especially the poorest, are impacted. So there's a lot of turbulence in the world. There's a lot of strife. And you offer and present these 7 rules. We're not going to have time to go through them all. The first one is get married and have lots of children. Then the second one is be Catholic and practice your faith. And then you have another rule, be Catholic and believe in the empire and in subsidiarity. Stand for law and justice, know who you are, be brave in battle and have a great general and die well. And be Catholic actually is broken into, that's rule one, broken into 3 separate chapters. People listening to this will say, oh, here he goes, talking about his Catholicism. He's a holier than thou sort of guy maybe. You know, there's a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment in the world today. Yeah. Edward, you know that a big backlash is, as it were, and there's a lot of reasons why that is. But how do you defend that? In other words, when people say, why is it so important to be a Catholic? Well, I could be an atheist and live a good life.
I admire atheists who manage to live a good life. I know a few. I know quite a few that impress me with their selflessness and their high ethical standard. But like in marriage, I don't know how you do it without faith. And this goes for all of life. And I mean, I think atheists are very courageous because they stand against several 100,000 years of human history. Humans were always religious. From the earliest cave paintings and before that, burial of the dead, humans were always religious. They believed in an afterlife. It seems to be part of our fabric of existence, for DNA. Aristotle said that we are, I transcribe, helplessly transcendental. There's 2 possible explanations. One of them is that we realize that the world is a terrible place, so we invent a magical being that solves everything. And the other possibility is that if we have been created by this magical being and faith has been woven into our DNA, and that's how I see it, of course. But I believe that faith makes everything better. That's my very clear experience in my family, in my personal life. Most of all, it makes me humble. If you know your roots, if you know your faith roots, if you know your traditional roots, then you don't become arrogant. I think we live in a time, as you said before, where everybody is alone, everybody's on his phone, everybody is on the internet all the time. We don't ever have a calm moment because every empty moment in our days is filled with entertainment from our phones. And this is a bit for me like stretching a rubber band too far. We're not made for that kind of stuff. And faith and liturgy and beauty and tradition, all these things help to settle us, help to ground us, help to put our feet back on the ground again. And I truly believe this. I truly believe this. God has created us so that every 7th day must be a day of silence and of prayer, of transcendence. I believe all of that. But it doesn't mean that you have to be an intolerant, sad, grim, suppressed person. Most people on Twitter following me probably will see that I am a very lively person that loves from Japanese animation via King Kong to Electric Light Orchestra, all sort of things. There is space for all of this if you're a Catholic. You don't have to be grim in the corner all the time, and I'm not. So, yes, that's a strong plaidoyer. If you haven't become Catholic so far, do join the club. And if you If you want me to pray for you, I'll become old televangelist right now. Write me a direct message via Twitter. I will pray for you. And I also do it. I write it down and I do it when I do my prayers.
I was going to ask you about how you practice your faith. And before I do that, I want to say that you have this growing social media presence. You're nearly at 60,000 followers on Twitter. I'm going to follow you, by the way.
Thank you very much. I spend far too much time on Twitter. I have lots of fun. And you know, my experience on Twitter is a very positive one. Most people say it's a terrible place, but there is a German speaking saying is the way that you call into a forest, it will echo back to you. And what I feel on Twitter is I'm moving in a very well-meaning, wonderful bubble of wholesome people around me, people who react to me, because I try to be wholesome, I try to be life-affirming, I try to be friendly, fun, gentle. And there's some people who will meet me and say, be angry because I'm Catholic or because I'm a Habsburg. They will yell at me and write that I'm an inbred moron or something like that.
Yeah.
Or then they will post pictures of Habsburgs with Habsburg jaw. Or they will post pictures of Gavrilo Princip, the guy who killed Franz Ferdinand, like, you know, menacing. I react in a positive way to that. I react in a friendly way. And I believe that this is the way to go. And so far it has worked wonderfully.
So you don't hold any grudges or resentments. You forgive people when they maybe throw insults at you.
Yes, because I can almost always see where these angers come from. They very rarely have something to do with me. I don't get aggressive if someone is not a Catholic but an atheist, because it was probably part of his biography to get there where he is. And I was lucky enough to have a good experience with faith, a very good experience. And thank God my children so far have too. But I don't bear grudges. I have a great sense of humor. People always think that they can make me angry by posting pictures of inbred Habsburgs with just not really. I always say, guys, this is 400 years ago. We live now. But go ahead if it makes you happy.
Yeah. Well, that's good to have a sense of humor. It'll get us through lots of dark times. And there's an old quote or something, the shortest distance between two friends is a good laugh or a sense of humor, something along that. So your Hungarian ambassador to the Holy See, is that an intense, demanding job? Do you have to report to the steps of the Vatican and to the Pope on a regular basis?
It is a surprisingly intense job. People imagine ambassadors standing around with a bored expression on their face with a glass of champagne in the hand and smiling limpidly and not being able to say anything interesting. But that's not the way it is. It's an incredible intense power game around the current Vatican, with a very strongly political Pope that interacts with the entire world. You have a very, very impressive Secretary of State having relations with hundreds of countries in the world. And you know, as you said before, Hungary is in the spotlight. So it's even more fun to be ambassador for Hungary to a place like the Vatican, to get into debates about topics like migration and other things. There's always something. No, you don't meet the Pope as often as people would imagine you would. You meet him, you know, once a year at the reception where you shake his hand and have 10 seconds. Once, twice a year at general audiences when you briefly meet him, about 20 to 40 minutes when you meet him the first time and you hand over your letter. And if I would or want to meet the Pope, something where it's absolutely necessary that I would meet him, I would probably get an appointment, but I don't even need to. Yeah. So we're intensely aware of what the Pope says, what he does, what he writes. We follow all of this. We write reports the entire day. We have several meetings per day. You are the last meeting of a long series of meetings that I had today. I'm enjoying this. I'm loving it. I'm in a way, I'm made for this. God created me so that I could do this well. It's like watching a beautiful, huge puzzle come together. You collect little details that you add. you meet someone, he says something in the byline and says, ah, this fits up here. You know, it's a little piece in the puzzle with the pink cloud. And it's wonderful. It's the most wonderful job in the world.
Where do you put the state of the Catholic Church today? Where in your mind is it at? Some people point to a decline in the West. Others are more optimistic.
I would say yes to both. I would say I see a decline. I see, as Benedict XVI once put it, a crisis of faith. I think the main crisis of the church is a crisis of faith. We have many Catholics who don't even know their faith anymore, who just are Catholic by stamp at their childhood. If you have a crisis of faith, that's bad. The church structure is something very weak, especially in Europe and in the West. A bit stronger in Central European countries, but there is so much hope because the solutions are very simple, very down to earth, and be practiced by every single Christian worldwide, as they have been over the last 2,000 years of church history. The solution is always personal, living the sacraments, living your faith, turning towards God, trying to become a saint. The more people do that, the more the church will become a strong force in society again. Right now it isn't. Right now it very definitely isn't. But I'm very optimistic. From what I see in my children and my children's friends, things are looking up. Still not in huge numbers, but really looking up. And I'm full of hope. We should always be full of hope. We're Christians.
The Habsburg Way, 7 Rules for Turbulent Times. That's your new book out. Why did you write this? What inspired you?
I have to be honest. A friend in America told me, why don't you write a book about the Habsburgs? And I said, what kind of book? And they say, don't know what would come to mind. And then I thought about a talk I gave in Boston. I gave a talk in Boston in a club. And a friend of mine told me to give a talk to these Bostonians about the Habsburg family and to talk about what are the central principles of your family. And he said, but don't begin with a Catholic faith because quite a few of them are not Catholic. So I said, hey, yeah, right. We're not just Catholic. We are standing for other things too. So I sat down with a pen and a piece of paper and I called a few uncles and I flipped through a few books and I made a list of points that are typical Habsburg. And I gave that talk and I kept, of course, my notes for the talk. And about half a year later, this American friend said, why don't you try to write a book for Sophia Press about the Habsburgs? And I said, well, funny you should ask. I've got an idea. And I pitched that, and they liked it. And then I began writing, and then the real work began, of course. And I discovered so much about my family, so many wonderful stories and anecdotes. But I'm pretty confident in these 7 rules that I point out here are the seven central principles of our family. And as I said in the beginning of this talk, I present them for our times. I think they are good for humans everywhere, not just for the Habsburg family. That was how the book came about. And of course, right now I'm going to be in the States in the first week of May. I'm going to make a tour in the New England era. I'm going to be in Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. I'm going to read from my book. And then, of course, after that, I'm going to begin to think what my next book will be.
Wow, you have great energy, and it's the Habsburg Way. I recommend it highly. Just want to go back real quickly and make sure I get it in. Should have asked it at the beginning. But you did speak about Hungary and the EU and democracy and so on. So it does sound to me like you believe in the democratic system. You still also have this imperial legacy. Do you think they can coexist? Maybe you can have some kind of a monarchy as a figurehead or as a constitutional monarchy. You're not talking about monarchists as autocrats, are we?
Okay, John, let me tell you the most surprising discovery that I made when I wrote that book. And the reason is I wrote it for the American public. If you read it, you will notice that I every now and then address the American public and say, you know, like you in the States. I discovered that there are many similarities between American democracy and the Habsburg Empire, which is very surprising as an idea. But I would say quite a few principles are there. In the end, it's about freedom and responsibility. But if you ask me whether I could see a compromise between republic, democratic American ideas, and the kind of monarchy that the Habsburg would think about, I still have to think about that. I don't think you can be pregnant and not pregnant at the same time. I think if you want the monarchy, it should be a real monarchy with a monarch that can actually have a veto, can actually say, no, we don't do this. And I don't want a monarch that is totally dependent on the will of the people, because what if the majority stands for bad ideas? What if the majority suppresses a minority, as we sometimes observe? What if, in the Third Reich, you would have a majority in agreement with persecuting the Jews? That's democracy, right? I think monarchy can give elements that can help democratic structures, but we would have to discuss it in detail.
Yep. It's very complicated and open to various interpretations, but you do make an interesting point that a democracy is a beautiful thing that we've adopted, and all the other systems have huge flaws. But with democracy, you also have the freedom to destroy yourself as a nation with the wrong ideals.
Yes, and I would go further and say democracy, the way it is really thought, as the people vote for politicians who then will do politics according to what the majority of the people in the country think and believe, right? This works. But we live in a time where many people have the impression that the great lines of politics aren't being done inside the nation anymore, but are being decided on a higher level. You have the impression that some globalist ideas interfere so strongly that single nations even don't have a say anymore. And there is no democratic legitimization in this case. People don't have a say about many of the political decisions that are being made anymore. And this worries me, because if democracy is not close to the people, close to the ground, close to the voters, then things can go wrong. And I have the impression that over the last 3 years, we've seen many things that made us believe that perhaps democracy is something fragile and open to being misused. And so, I feel that, when Roosevelt visited Emperor Franz Joseph in the beginning of the 20th century, and they had a conversation of about 38 minutes in the Hofburg in Vienna, and Roosevelt asked the emperor in that conversation, he asked him rather pointedly, now that we have, parliaments and elections and representatives, what exactly is your job as an emperor? As in, do we really need you? And Franz Joseph said, my job is to protect my people from my politicians. And that is a thought. Who protects us from our politicians?
That's a good thought to almost reach the end of our interview. A fascinating one. And we'll have to bring you back to pick up on that. Edward, it's the Habsburg Way, 7 Rules for Turbulent Times, Sophia Institute Press. If people want to order it, go up on Amazon, go up on the Sophia Institute Press website. Any other details you want to share? How can people reach you, your social media handles?
Follow me on Twitter. You just go on Twitter and you type Edward Habsburg and you will find my account. I still have a number of followers that I can still react to direct messages, and mostly react to all of the interactions on Twitter. So I'm still sort of accessible on Twitter. So join the team now. Let's say the other thing. I don't know when you're going to post this, John, but there is a very, very exciting Habsburg Championship going on Twitter right now. We are in the quarterfinals. There's only 8 Habsburg, male Habsburgs, and 8 female Habsburgs left, and we're in the knockout phase. So, for instance, right now you can vote in a match between Mary of Burgundy and Leopoldina of Brazil. And so you go on Twitter and join in and vote. I also believe in democracy sometimes.
So will I be able to get a vote in here? I hope I do.
Go ahead, go on my Twitter account and vote for Mary of Burgundy, and make sure that you vote for Mary of Burgundy and not for Leopoldina of Brazil, because she's in the second place right now, but I feel that all the Brazilians are going to go online in the next hours will vote for her anyway.
Eduard Habsburg, you're the Archduke of Austria, Ambassador of Hungary to the Holy See. It's been great catching up with you, and I'm going to have you back. Take care.
You are listening to Dig Life Deep with John Aidan Byrne. You can reach the host in the U.S. at 973-529-4699. That's 973-529-4699. 973-529-4699. Email burndesk@gmail.com. That's burndesk, B-Y-R-N-E, desk@gmail.com. burndesk@gmail.com. Subscribe for free.